KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
East Oakland.
Emeryville.
Alameda.
Temescal.
Coming up, we'll hear just how many murders go unsolved in the city of Richmond. And it's not just there.
It's sort of a little known fact that a lot of homicides go unsolved everywhere.
We'll get the findings of an investigative report. Then, tomorrow's tax day. Did you know that not every country has such a dreaded day?
For an Estonian, even talking about tax filing in the US, trying to understand the system, it is too much effort.
Plus, we'll visit a coffee shop in Berkeley training refugees to be baristas.
We'd always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then foster conversations around refugees, and it's actually been the opposite of that. More the supportive refugees are what drawing people in.
Insight and coffee beans. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. The murder rate across Bay Area cities has risen in the last 2 years, reflecting national trends. But when a homicide happens in the city of Richmond, the chances that the assailant will be arrested are pretty low. In fact, the city has the second lowest clearance rates for homicides in the state of California. Why is that, and what's being done about it? The San Francisco Chronicle assigned a team, including data and investigative reporter Joaquin Palomino, to examine those questions. He sat down in studio with KALW's Ben Trefney to share some answers, beginning with what he found when he looked at information from the Department of Justice.
I looked at this data, and I was just sort of reviewing homicides and clearances over a five-year time period and noticed that in California, out of the police agencies that were handling, you know, relatively high number of homicides, Richmond had a really low clearance rate. In fact, like out of all police agencies in the state that were dealing with more than 10 homicides a year, they had the second to the worst, second only to Compton. And so that prompted me to, you know, call Richmond and talk to them about it. And they said, oh, yeah, okay, the DOJ data, it's a little, there are some problems with it. They cited a technical error. So I requested their own, you know, sort of internal police records. And so the DOJ data shows that, you know, the Richmond police are clearing about, I think it's 27% of homicides, which is a really low number.
Now, how does that compare with some of the other big cities around the Bay Area?
So like Oakland, for example, they clear 40%. San Francisco clears about half of the homicides in the city. And this is between 2011 and 2015.
I mean, even those numbers don't sound that great.
They don't. No, and the statewide average is about 64, 65%. It's sort of a little known fact that a lot of homicides go unsolved everywhere. And then Richmond, according to the DOJ numbers, it's you know, 27%. In their own figures, it's a little bit closer to 40%. But both of those are relatively low.
Still
for
low.
A large police agency. And so the first question is just why, right? Why are so many homicides going unsolved in Richmond? And so we talked to the police, we talked to the mayor, we talked to a bunch of people in the community, and sort of the consensus was, Richmond's a small city, it has a big crime problem. So they don't have the same sorts of resources that, say, you know, San Francisco has or even Oakland has. So their homicide investigation team is relatively small. They're handling a lot. They're handling violent felonies, they're handling homicides. They don't have the capacity to have, you know, for example, a cold case investigator, which investigates old homicides that are still open, which has been really effective in other places. And so that was one issue, is resources.
Even though they dedicate more resources to than a lot of other Contra Costa County communities.
Yeah, even then, just because considering its size, the amount of crime in that city is you know, pretty high. And then the other issue that the police were citing a lot was gang violence. A lot of the homicides in Richmond are gang related, and in those types of homicides, it's hard to get witnesses to talk. And a lot of that is that, you know, while according to the people we spoke with, while community police relations have improved, you know, overall big picture in the city of Richmond, there's still pockets of the city, you know, particularly where gun violence is prevalent, where there still is a distrust of the police. There still is sort of this reluctance to help with investigations because people either fear that, you know, the cops might not be able to protect them, or they do not want to cooperate with law enforcement.
That's Joaquin Palomino. He is data and investigative journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle. So as a data reporter, in this story, there are a lot of data sets that are presented graphically for the audience. It's really useful, and it's interesting to look at. What were some of the most interesting ones that you found?
So the overall homicide clearance rate in Richmond has hovered between 30 and 50% since 2006. But the number of cases that actually make it to court where there's a criminal complaint filed is much lower. It's always been 25% in some years. One year was only 1 in 5 homicides actually ended up in court.
It's so frustrating for victims.
Yeah. And so that's frustrating for victims. It's frustrating for police. And it really has an impact on public safety because, particularly in Richmond, a lot of homicides are retaliatory. So if you don't catch the person, then there's a good chance that they may end up being the next victim or someone else, like in the case that we profiled, may just end up sort of in the crossfire and an innocent person as well may end up being killed. So, yeah, that was probably the most interesting thing I saw in the data. And also just seeing the huge variation in clearances from city to city.
Well, one of those is particularly interesting to me, and you highlighted towards the end of the story about Santa Ana in Orange County and the dramatic change they made in the clearances they were able to make on homicide cases. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so the Santa Ana Police Department was sort of dealing with similar things to Richmond in the late 1990s, early 2000s, where they were having, you know, a high number of gang-related homicides. Violence was increasing. Violent crime was increasing. They had a low officer-to-resident ratio. They didn't have a lot of resources. And they had a really, really bad clearance rate. Homicides were not being solved in that city.
It was 28%, it says, in 1993.
Yeah. And so they made it. The police chief at the time made it sort of a concerted effort to improve that number. And he invested tons of resources into, you know, the homicide investigation squad. He created a new unit that focused solely on gang-related shootings or gang-related homicides, rather. And if you look at the data, it's kind of incredible. The homicide clearance rate just sort of steadily improves year after year after year. And at one point, they were even clearing homicides, not only all the homicides in a given year, but homicides from prior years as well.
Yeah, you described that as they were clearing more than 100% of homicides.
Yeah, which is, it's hard to wrap your mind around it, but basically they were solving old cases that had been backlogged. And even now, I mean, I looked at the data for 2015, I think it was 80%. I mean, it's still really, really high in Santa Ana. And yeah, Santa Ana is a different city than Richmond. You know, every city is unique and every city's crime problem is unique. But they did a lot of things sort of structurally within the department that helped them improve their investigations and then helped them solve murders. And so we thought that would be a great agency to profile. And honestly, there was a number of agencies in the state we could have chosen as well.
It's interesting that in the Bay Area, though, the numbers are generally in these cities below the state average of clearances. I mean, it's not just Richmond.
Yeah, San Francisco's below average. Oakland is below average over this time period.
I mean, Oakland has an understaffed police department and has had for quite a while and dealing with a lot of other administrative issues for over a decade now. San Francisco has a pretty well-staffed police department and also a fairly small footprint as a city. So for them not to clear as many cases as the state average also seems like something's going on that's not all right.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I wish I knew why, but you know, maybe that's next follow-up story is looking at specifically San Francisco, but I, you know, I'm not sure what's going on there.
So what do you see as the best solutions then for cities that are facing these problems with clearance rates?
From most of the experts we talk to, I mean, there's sort of this divide. Some people say that the structure of the department doesn't play as big of a role as the nature of homicides. Others argue that, you know, how the police department deploys resources is actually key and really important in their homicide clearance rates. But most people agreed overall that improving community relations is best because homicides in particular, I mean, you're dealing with witnesses. There's not always a lot of forensic evidence. And so you're relying on getting people to talk. And the best way to get people to talk is if they trust police. They trust that police can take care of them. They trust that, you know, they will be safe and, you know, they have generally good attitude towards law enforcement. And so that's something that Richmond really has done. They've been investing in community policing heavily. And so this takes time. You know, it will take time to get people in certain areas where gun violence is prevalent to, you know, cooperate with law enforcement.
Joaquin Palomino is a data and investigative reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. Find a link to Joaquin's story about homicides in the city of Richmond at KALW.org. Click crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our news department has a visiting journalist this year, Jürgen Klemm, a professional broadcaster from Estonia. It's a very small country in northeastern Europe, 5,500 miles away. And he's been giving us insights into both his culture and traditions, as well as our own. This month, we asked our resident foreign correspondent something we thought was super boring. How do Estonians file their taxes? And the answer surprised us.
A couple of weeks ago, I received an email reminding me that it would soon be time to file my US tax return for the year 2016. The email said that first and foremost, I do have to locate my W-2 form showing my earnings and taxes for last year. Secondly, if I decided to use tax service, I would have to find a reputable company that is aware of the specific conditions concerning my visa and the specific laws of the state of California. But if I decided to file my own taxes, I would need to find the 1040NREZ form on the IRS webpage. For an Estonian, even talking about tax filing in the US, trying to understand the system, it is too much effort. This story has, up to this point, used about 1 minute of airtime. And this is approximately how long it took me to file my Estonian tax return. About 1 minute. Let me walk you through the process. I have to log into my bank account, where I will find my tax return form, which has already been filled in for me. There I see my annual income, the taxes I paid, and the amount of over or underpaid taxes. Then I click one button to confirm that all of the information is correct and I agree to it. And that's about it. 1 minute. Just think about it for a second. All of the information required for tax forms already exists in digital databases. So in my case, my Estonian employer has stated my annual salary and my income tax can be very easily calculated by that. My doctor and hence our digitized healthcare system knows exactly how many days I was sick and how much sick leave I've received. And my bank account states my exact income, so there is really no reason for me to duplicate this information and fill it in on paper. In the Estonian case, the Tax and Customs Board pre-fills the tax forms based on the information they already have. So they're not asking me to prove I have paid the right amount of tax. Rather, they're asking me to make sure it taxed me correctly. How is it possible that the Estonians can enjoy this luxury of filing their taxes in 1 minute with a single mouse click? A very important aspect to keep in mind is the minuscule size of my country, especially as compared to the United States. For us, tax reform is much easier. As an example, imagine changing direction in a kayak. You can do a full turn within seconds without moving any distance. But this is not the case if you want to turn around an oil tanker. The small size of my country also means that we simply can't afford complicated systems. Using our people for the things that computers can do is a luxury we are not able to indulge. Maybe you have heard about a small Estonian company called Starship Technologies that's testing small delivery robots from Redwood City, California to Washington, D.C. The idea springs directly from the fact that it's too costly to use people to do the same job. And surely you have heard about this idea to connect San Francisco and LA with Hyperloop trains, which would enable travel by rail at speeds faster than airlines. This is something a lot of people think of as an utopian fantasy. Well, for us, building a Hyperloop train under the Baltic Sea is probably the most efficient and reasonable way to connect to our neighboring capitals. For us, this is very real. But this is a different kind of reality, the underdog reality, because we, as underdogs, cannot afford to take the ineffective way.
Jürgen Klemm is an Estonian journalist working in our news department. Find more of his dispatches at kalw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. When refugees are resettled in the Bay Area, they have to find work quickly in order to cover the region's high cost of rent. That can be difficult with a limited resume and references. To help bridge this gap, a coffee company in Berkeley is providing job training and employment to refugees and asylees. KALW's Jeremy Ju has more.
We're here to go.
To go.
You want a room for tea? $4.
Nazira Bobery moves around the 1951 coffee shop with ease, mixing, steaming, grinding coffee, whipping up espressos and almond milk lattes like a pro. But the truth is, she's new to this, and not so long ago, she was in a very different place.
You know, my last job was with United Nations as a communication consultant.
Before that, she worked as a journalist in Afghanistan, her home country. There, she had everything.
I had home, family, friend, job, career, everything, but I was not safe.
Her husband felt threatened because of his job. And so last year, even though she really didn't want to, they left. On December 5th, Bobery arrived in San Francisco. She became one of nearly 4,000 special immigrant visa holders resettled in California in 2016. And even as an experienced traveler with an apartment waiting for her in the Bay Area, she still had a really hard time adjusting.
You know, for 1 month, I really struggled a lot.
She worried about friends and family back home, felt childlike in her inability to communicate. And the isolation, stress, and helplessness wore on her. She didn't leave her house.
You know, staying at home 24 hours is the most difficult thing. For 2 weeks, I just got sick. I just cried and said, I want to do something.
So she reached out to the International Rescue Committee and told them exactly what she needed.
See, if you really want to do something for me, I need a job.
And then someone there connected her to where she's working right now, a coffee company in Berkeley with a mission to employ refugees.
When refugees first come in, one of the most crucial pieces is helping them find a job.
That's Doug Hewitt. He and Rachel Tabor founded 1951 Coffee Company after working at the International Rescue Committee.
The U.S. government expects for them to be economically self-sufficient within about 6 months of arrival. And so finding that job as soon as possible is critical.
This means shortly after arriving, a refugee is expected to pay their rent, repay their plane ticket, and find a job quickly. And it is this urgency, Rachel Tabor explains, that really limits their employment opportunities.
Regardless of someone's background, be it they were a lawyer, a doctor, a farmer, a teacher, an accountant, it doesn't matter what role they played in their home country, they will find an entry-level position when they arrive.
So Tabor and Hewitt brainstormed ways they could help refugees find jobs, and the coffee industry kept coming up. The positions are forward-facing, so newcomers can work on their English. Plus, Oakland is one of the nation's major coffee ports where tons of unroasted green coffee beans are stored.
And San Francisco and Oakland are the first and third respective highest paying barista incomes in the country.
So they founded the 1951 Coffee Company. Hewitt says they named it after the year the United Nations first defined the guidelines for the protection of refugees.
We saw that as a very inspirational moment historically, and we want to be a part of that protection and that ongoing, you know, building process for them.
They initially launched a training program to get as many refugees into the coffee industry as possible. Then, earlier this year in January, just 5 days before President Trump's immigration ban, they opened their own cafe, the 1951 Coffee Shop.
We have 10 baristas from 7 different countries. That represents 7 different refugee communities that are here in the Bay Area.
And Nazira Bobery is one of them. And right now, she's mixing up a cappuccino with her colleague, Meg Karki, a refugee from Bhutan. Their shared experience as refugees creates a sense of support.
We feel like a family because we don't have family here, but we make a new family here. Like if everyone just take care of each other.
And that's evident in the way they interact. As they prep an iced latte, around them sit customers of all different ages, all different backgrounds, sipping on their lattes, engaged in conversation, learning about the challenges that refugees face through the infographics that decorate the walls. Here's Tabor again.
We'd always thought that we would bring people in with coffee and then hopefully foster conversations around refugees and the support, and it's actually been the opposite of that. More the support of refugees are what drawing people in.
And Bulberry and the other baristas see that, and it makes them feel good.
Some of them want to know, where are you from? They want to know about the stories, about the situation. And at least they give a comment that life gonna be okay, don't worry. These comments make us happy.
That's not to say Bulberry feels completely at home now, or isn't sometimes frustrated with what she's had to leave behind. But compared to 3 months ago, she's in a better place.
16-ounce chai latte.
Happy that she is back to work and hopeful for the future. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Ju.
Jeremy Ju is a student reporter in KALW's Audio Academy. Other members of the class are Kavalroop Singh and Bowen Wang. Our team today also includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. The show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer is Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll reveal the secret history of Italian immigrants in the Bay Area during World War II.
She used to say in Italian, "Non abbiamo fatto niente a nessuno. We have done nothing to no one. Why is this happening?"
Hidden stories of civil liberty violations tomorrow on Cross Currents. This music is by Howl Divine. The Bay Area Blues Band is scheduled to appear at Armando's in Martinez on Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Ooh, a black woman and just shake them on down to Most Hollow. Believe I'll shake them on down. Shake 'em on down.